Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, this week on In the Pink, I've got the pleasure of a new sponsor. And it's F1 Experiences. Now, for anyone who doesn't know about them, you should, because they're amazing. It is the official experience, hospitality and travel program for Formula One, offering you the chance of the closest experience possible to the sport. I, for one, cannot wait for fans to be back in full force, so why not do it in style with F1 Experiences? Enjoy the best race tickets, trackside hospitality, first-class hotels, and unparalleled access. You get as close as possible to all the action thanks to F1 Experiences. And as In the Pink listeners, you can save 5% off your next package by using the code INTHEPINK, all one word, and in capitals, when you book online at f1experiences.com. What are you waiting for? Hello, welcome to In the Pink with me, Natalie Pinkham. And on this week's podcast, I'm joined by the Branson family, Richard and his two grown-up children, Holly and Sam. We talk in depth about what makes them tick as a family, how they support and learn from one another. We discuss everything from building the Virgin Empire to how Richard tried to avert the Iraq War, and up to the present day, the challenges of and fight back from the pandemic, plus Richard's brief adventure into Formula One, including losing a big bet to former Lotus boss Tony Fernandez. They are remarkable people. I really hope you enjoy our chat. Please welcome Team Branson to In the Pink. Well, hello, Richard. How are you? Looking incredibly fit and healthy as ever.
Thanks, Natalie. And obviously, you always look incredibly fit and healthy. So we're both lucky to be well.
As you know, I have already spoken to your two gorgeous children. It feels strange calling grown-ups children, but Holly and Sam, had a lovely chat with them both. And what I wanted to do is paint something of a family portrait and tell the story almost and at home with the Bransons and get a bit of insight into what makes you tick as a family. So I'd love to start by asking you what family means to you.
Family means everything, I suppose, ultimately. You know, I was very lucky from a very young age. I worked from a houseboat and the kids were born when I was on the houseboat with Joan. And I never went to an office, so the kids were always crawling around at my feet with whilst I was, you know, trying to sort of build the Virgin Empire. And but we were an incredibly close-knit family as a result. And I think I've always been a really close-knit family, and I was also lucky enough to come from two parents who loved each other a lot, and you know, so was brought up with a lot of love, and that, you know, I think that made everything, you know, everything the stronger.
So what are your kind of earliest memories of your childhood? How far back can you recount and recall those happy times?
I can remember my mum and dad were, you know, sort of struggling to pay the bills. So, you know, I would be put on the back of a motorbike, you know, strapped in behind my mum and dad, and we'd travel. And of course, I absolutely loved that. You know, we would go on holiday to Devon and go bass fishing, catch the sand eels in the sand, and then go bass fishing with my dad. And of course, you know, quite famously, my mum liked to see us stand on our own 2 feet. So aged about six, she pushed me out of the car and told me to make my own way to granny's house. And I got thoroughly lost. But anyway, it was her approach to try to make us stand on our own 2 feet. And I will be forever grateful that she brought us up in that way.
So how on earth did you find your way to granny's house at age six without a compass?
I got lost. It was in Devon. I ended up in a farmhouse. Of course, my poor mother was by then regretting what she'd done. Anyway, I got there in the end. Of course, today she would have been arrested, or I would have been taken away from her. By the end of the holiday, she was, you know, she'd stopped off at a fast flowing river and told me to try to win 10 shillings and swim, you learn to swim in this fast flowing river. And I managed to pull it off and get the 10 shillings. So she was, she would keep pushing.
There's no doubt that she was a remarkable woman. It's sad, I'm sure, for you to hear her referred to in the past tense, having lost her earlier this year. I mean, I guess that most mothers go through life panicking and telling their kids not to do things and get incredibly nervous. But she obviously had an inner confidence and calm about her to let you find out for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And I think that, you know, when it came to Polly and Sam's upbringing, I was perhaps slightly more the adventurous type, and Joan was slightly more the one who would like to keep them around for a full lifetime and would say no. And I think we had a good balance in bringing up our kids, and you know, and I think they've taken perhaps more after myself when it comes to adventure than Joan. I mean, Joan was brought up in a Glaswegian, you know, caretaker's house, so she never had the opportunity to learn to swim or play tennis, or, you know, she would just play on the street. And so our kids have obviously had greater opportunities and have taken them fully on.
I'm quite interested to know how your approach has perhaps changed from being a parent to a grandparent. I always hear that being a grandparent is actually more fun and more liberating in a way, because all the crap gets done by the parents and all the admin, all the boring stuff, and you get the fun part. Is that true? Has that been your experience?
To be honest, I just thoroughly enjoyed both experiences. I mean, with one's kids, every single year of their life gets better and better and better. It's been completely and utterly magical with both Ollie and Sam. Having five grandkids, it's a lot of fun. They're all under the age of five. You know, we've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time with them. You know, I tried to persuade them to call me Grand Dude, but I failed. They were Papa it is. Of course, they're completely and utterly adorable. Lola, the two-year-old, you know, she's got a great sense of humour, and she'll stick her bottom lip out and go, "I want my mummy," but she's just joking. And then I'll stick my bottom lip out and say, "I want my mummy too." it's great having kids. With Holly and Sam, I would always write down wonderful comments they made in my notebooks. One of my favourites was when Sam was about seven. Joan and I just got married on Necker, and some friends of ours announced they were going to get married. And he turned to me and said, "Daddy, they can't be getting married. They haven't had any children yet."
You know what? That reminds me of a card that a marriage card that I saw that said, "Getting married and not pregnant. My God, you're posh."
Oh, lovely. Helen's just given me a cup of tea.
How lovely. Little little reminder of home. Good bit of... Is it English breakfast?
Of course. Or actually, maybe Yorkshire. I love Yorkshire tea.
Oh, lovely.
English breakfast
for Yorkshire. So how do you describe Holly and Sam? Because what really struck me when I spoke to them both was how differently they approached our chats and how different they were in recounting the same memories, just in a very different way. And yet they're incredibly close, and yet they're not that similar as personalities. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I think, and I think they would agree. And Holly is the more studious, and, you know, she saw it through school and university and became a doctor. And became head girl at a predominantly boys' school. She then decided that she'd love to run our foundation. And she also, loves everything about what we're doing in our companies. Also, Sam is much more creative in an artistic sense. And, he's set up his own little film company, which has made some really strong films on things that we all agree on, breaking the taboo on drugs and other films. He's a wonderful musician and actually is really coming into his own, quite late for a musician. And his last three or four songs were I think, the best, by far and away the strongest songs that he's ever written and played. And, Isabella, his wife, sung the last song with him. And yeah, so that's, and I think Sam has felt more strongly about not being in his father's shadow, and therefore has, very determinedly done his own thing. And I mean, Holly's carved her own life. It hasn't bothered her at all, I think. Being different people sometimes means you're going to be much closer to a person, I think. If I made a list of how different Joan and myself are, it is dramatically different. I mean, she doesn't have a lot of interest in what I do and so on. But we love each other, completely. So, so sometimes opposites work well.
How would you describe Joan as a mother, as a grandmother, as a woman?
Yeah, she's an extraordinary woman. We've been together nearly 45 years, and she'll put up with her husband a bit, but being a mother and a grandmother is everything for her. Yeah, she's a great friend. She's got a great sense of humour, very dry sense of humour, very quick with the one-liners. So yeah, I have to be careful on occasions. But Ollie and Sam have had, I think, from both of us, unreserved love. And the grandkids will get the same from their parents. And that's all that matters in the end, is knowing that your parents feel that way towards you.
So let's hear now what Holly and Sam have to say about their mum, Joan.
My mum is amazing. She is our rock in our family. She's just kind and caring, and she's just always been there for all of us. And what's great is she really is Dad's rock. Like, even with all the different business ideas, he runs everything by her, everything. And she will say very frankly what she thinks. Sometimes he has to roll his eyes because she can be sometimes a bit too honest, but it's a good thing because I think he absolutely needs to be told exactly what she thinks. And she's shrewd and intelligent and has wonderful ideas. So I think you're absolutely right. Behind every strong man is a strong woman, and she is there for him, and she has been 100% there for me and my brother and now the grandkids, who are the apple of her eyes. When I walk in a room with them nowadays, they don't say hello to me anymore. It's all about them. But so I'm slightly an afterthought. Oh, Holly forgot to give you a cuddle. But it's so lovely just seeing how in love they are with the grandkids. And they're just the most wonderful grandparents.
Does she kind of shy away a little bit from the spotlight? Is she prefers to sort of be in the background a bit?
She doesn't just shy away. She hides away from the spotlight. It's never been her thing. She's always much preferred to be behind the scenes. And actually, I'm so thankful for her, because when we were growing up, she absolutely made sure we were behind the scenes as well. And I think my dad would have had us jumping off of buildings to launch aeroplanes and all sorts. But she managed to prevent that from happening until we were old enough to make the decision ourselves.
My mum is an earth mother. She's a working class Glaswegian, no shit. This is how it is, says whatever's on her mind. But through our entire life, she's just been an absolute rock and stays completely out of the public eye, completely protected Holly and I from being in the public eye as best she could till we were grown ups. And I think that really helped us sort of find ourselves on our own feet. She was the sort of mum that I'd have mates over for the weekend. And just as we got hungry, before we were like, oh my God, I need to go to the kitchen and make something, she would come in with like cheese and ham sandwiches. And you know, she's definitely the coolest member of our family for sure. And she's sort of a mum to everyone who comes into contact with her. She's just got that energy about her. And so, you know, she's a wonderful, woman and grateful to have her as a mum. And I think, you know, my dad, you know, certainly wouldn't have been able to accomplish what he's been able to accomplish in his life so far without her.
Now, we all know that Richard Branson is hands-on when it comes to business, but what about family? A little birdie told me that he even used to get up during the night to do night feeds when his grandchildren were newborns. I put that question to Holly.
Oh, he did. When we were together, him and my mum would take Etranati, and he would be like, right, once they were on bottles, so from about 6 months onwards, and they didn't sleep early. They probably should have been sleeping by then, but they didn't. And so we were broken, like looking at pictures of me and Freddie back then, we were absolutely broken. And my mum and dad would come around regularly, and they would take the kids at night, and they would do the night feeds, and they would look after them. And yeah, dad's unbelievably hands-on, and he always was. So mum used to say he was one of those very, very rare men back 40 years ago who would do nappies. Whereas lots of other men just wouldn't do that. Whereas dad was absolutely happy to do all the nappies, night feeds, all sorts. And that never changed.
What were the sort of pros and cons of having a dad as successful and high profile as Richard?
I mean, it's hard. You look at it reflectively as an adult, because when you're a child, that's just your life. Yeah. It's just the norm. You know, there's no big thing going on. It's just your dad's famous. And I mean, it definitely went from him being famous to not being able to walk down a back street in Kathmandu without someone recognizing him. But the lucky thing is my dad is incredibly well respected, and he's done some really amazing things, and his whole gear, even with business, has been how can he contribute to the world. And you know, he's been such an inspiration to me in my life about how to do and create amazing things and have influence, but do it with real integrity and dignity and grace. And that's really nice. So there's a difference between a celebrity and someone who's famous. You know, it's like a celebrity is someone who's famous for being themselves. Then there's someone who's famous for what they've done. And so anyone who's sort of approached dad has always had this enamored, just real sense of respect. So it's been really lovely in that regard. I think what it does is it puts a bit of a self-awareness lens more than probably what most people have. And I think that's part of my thing that I untangled is sort of self-consciousness, self-awareness that comes from natural shyness and preconceived perceptions of who you may be, which people have. And, you know, the feeling like one needs to kind of go the extra mile to be seen as who they are. And that takes up a lot of bandwidth, but actually as I've sort of grown up, it's like, flog off all that crap. Like, and just being oneself. And then also, you know, my dad was an adventurer. He went off on balloon trips that I didn't know he was going to come back from. And it wasn't until I was a grown up that I realized how much that impacted me. And it was a wonderful thing. Like, he's the man he is. And being an adventurer now, I know why he did it, and I could still go on my adventures. But you know, there was that sort of stuff too, but equally
anxiety about his safety. You mean for a small child,
anxiety about his safety. Yeah. Anxiety about his safety and just, yeah, whether he was going to come home. I mean, that was pretty intense. but also equally alongside all that, you know, real excitement and wonderful things and opportunities and travel and meeting interesting people. And but more than anything, he's my dad, and he's an absolutely incredible, loving, big-hearted, warm person. And I was always, you know, I spent a lot more time with my dad than I think a lot of people's dads got to spend with their dads, because he worked from home and included us in everything. So yeah, ups and downs and lefts and rights and bonuses and setbacks and a wonderful enriching life.
Well, we know plenty about his ability to build an empire, but what of Richard's political and diplomatic skills? Well, he set up a group called the Elders and another called the B Team. Here's what they're all about.
I think the world needs a group of elders, who people who are in the last 20 years of their lives, who've led exemplary lives, who have high moral authority, who have enormous wisdom and knowledge and a lifetime of skills. You know, there was a time when the Iraq War was about to happen and America and Britain were about to invade, that I attempted to persuade Saddam Hussein to step down in order to avoid the war and go and live in Libya. And he was open to doing so, but he wanted some elders to fly to Iraq to talk to him and then fly out with him. And this was before the elders were formed. And I talked to Nelson Mandela and he agreed to go. And then, but he wanted Kofi Annan, who was Secretary General of the United Nations, to go with him. I talked to Kofi and he said he would go with Nelson Mandela. And then sadly, a few days before the trip took place, the bombings of Baghdad started and the meeting never took place. But as a result of that, Nelson Mandela and Graca Machel, his wife, and Kofi and Archbishop Tutu and Mary Robinson and a number of other incredible people got together to form the Elders. And they now go into conflict regions. And they'll also speak out on issues like climate change and nuclear proliferation and other issues that are really, really important issues that need a group of people who are above government, but have enormous respect younger politicians who are there in power today. And then the B team was an organization that, you know, sitting, listening to the elders, I just one day thought, you know, we a group of business leaders with the same sort of respect could use their entrepreneurial and business skills to try to speak out and tackle issues, things like corruption in business or, again, climate change, obviously, is one that the B team have worked with the elders on. And, you know, the B team and the elders went together to the Paris talks. And, you know, the business leaders would go in and see the Chinese representatives or the Indian representatives and give the business reason why it made sense for these countries to support the Paris Accord, you know, arguing that, you know, all this money is pouring out of your country to the Middle East for oil. You know, if you create solar and if you create wind, the money will stay within the country, and then the elders would use the moral authority as to why they should do it. The precious earth and so on. Together, they were a powerful force. So business leaders like Paul Pullman, who had a tremendous reputation at Unilever and Mohammed Yunus, and different leaders from different countries around the world. Yes, they've been good organisations to be involved with.
Absolutely incredible and amazing to think how different the course of history would have been had that meeting been able to happen in the first place. But no doubt they've changed these sort of sliding door moments, if you like, and they would have changed the course of history with the meetings they did manage to stage. Absolutely amazing to be part of that. And looking forward, is it an evolving organisation that will just keep getting new members and keep making a difference where it matters most? What yes. are your, I mean, you must have pretty high hopes for what they can achieve.
Yeah. I think they are elders, and therefore elders don't last forever. So sadly, we lost Kofi Annan last year on an elder's mission to Zimbabwe. He got pneumonia and continued despite being feeling really unwell. He was replaced by Ban Ki-moon, who just stepped down as his successor at the United Nations. So Mary Robinson has now taken over the chair of the elders, and she is looking out for, you know, wonderful people who could become future elders as we lose some of the current elders. So we have a group of 12 elders who are, it's a remarkable people. It's wonderful and fascinating to sit at their feet and listen to them discuss issues.
Absolutely. What a privilege, what an honour. And how do you decide what goes on the agenda, if you like?
Well, the elders make the decisions as to what they wish to tackle. They will take on issues that where they think they might be able to bring some expertise to it, something unique. And sometimes they'll succeed and sometimes they'll fail. I mean, you know, Myanmar, the horrible suppression of the uprisings that took place by the generals there. You know, I'm sure that behind the scenes, the elders have been working on that. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they wouldn't be. Yeah, there are more recent conflicts that have just happened that I'm sure that they're involved with. So if they feel that they can bring something unique to a particular situation, then they'll dive in and see whether they can help, you know. And then we have a group of advisors, and I'm one of those advisors who will travel with them on trips. And we've been to Darfur, and we've been to Ethiopia and Zimbabwe and you know, China, and anyway, all sorts of different countries, Iran, you know, Russia, and the elders will go and see, you know, they'll go and see people that a lot of people in the West would not think of seeing. So they might go and spend the weekend with, you know, President Putin or the Ayatollah in Iran, and so that try to get the picture from the other side. And so if a real crisis breaks out, they have a relationship and they can try to intervene to help.
Well, what a power for good both the elders and the B team are. Now, we've all endured crises of varying degrees in the last year or so, and ostensibly Richard has nailed the work-life balance. I wanted to know if he had any COVID coping mechanisms that we could all benefit from.
Well, I think one of the good things about the lockdown is for a lot of jobs, people will have realised that actually working from home is better than working from an office. And hopefully good employers will allow people to do that in future years. For some jobs, it's just not possible. But for a lot of jobs, I think it is possible. And if you work from home, which I've done all my life, you can, first of all, make sure that, I compare it to circles. So first of all, you draw a circle around yourself and you make sure that the person within that circle is fit and healthy and not drinking too much and, you know, getting a decent balance. And once you know that, you know, you're feeling strong like that, you can then draw a bigger circle and then around your family and your friends and your neighbours, and then further on in life, your circle around your city. And then if you build a big company, a circle around the world. But that first circle is the absolute critical one. And I think people have either used lockdown to really get fit and healthy themselves. And if you get yourself really fit and healthy, I think you can find a few extra hours in the day, even although it may take a couple of hours to get yourself fit and healthy every day. But you'll find that you'll be able to achieve many more hours of other useful things because of it. Some people have done it the right way. Others have let themselves go somewhat. And I suspect after lockdown, they'll have to think hard about getting their bodies and their minds back and fit again. I can't overemphasize the importance of that. You know, I can work through crises. We've had quite a few of those, as everybody has in the last 18 months. If I'm feeling fit and healthy and well, and of course, you know, if you have your family around, I mean, that, you know, that's another really important thing, I think, in times of crisis.
So the first circle, is that just the individual in your mind, or does that include the nuclear family?
The first circle should just be yourself, not even your partner. Just, you know, get yourself, I mean, you can gently encourage your partner, but get yourself into a wonderful frame of mind. I'm lucky enough, I'm able to play tennis every morning and every evening. Living where I live, I can go kite surfing, I pop into the gym, do weights, and, you know, do two extreme cycling sessions a week, and you know, that all takes a bit of time. But, you know, when you actually work out your time, you'll find that if you weren't doing that, a lot of it may be spent vegging in front of a television set, or, you know, or more time on iPads or iPhones. And, you know, I think it's just a really important to try to find interesting ways of getting fit and healthy.
Now, I'm just going to take a brief break in this Branson podcast to tell you about my friends at Camp Kerala. And that is in light of the recent news that's got us all buzzing that the British Grand Prix is going to have a capacity crowd. So exciting. For over 15 years, Camp Kerala have provided an unrivaled luxury canvas accommodation in some of nature's unique settings. To you and me, that's a posh tent in some of the coolest places on earth, from Glastonbury to the Nevada desert, and now to the centre of Silverstone for the British Grand Prix. I am talking unparalleled luxury in the exclusive inner circuit. So you can wake up trackside on the hangar straight, just metres from the action. And you can avoid all the hassle of travelling to and from the track each day, instead enjoying 3 days of fun and on-track action from the viewing deck of Camp Kerala. There's also live music and fantastic food. It's basically like a five-star hotel within touching distance of the British Grand Prix. I mean, it's the stuff dreams are made of. I really hope you can come and join us. To book, contact Faye, F-A-Y-E, at Camp Kerala, CampKerala.com, and use the code in the pink, all one word, capital letters, for a 5% discount on your booking. Great stuff. Happy days. Okay, let's get back to the Branson podcast. So according to Holly, how does her dad get it right? And how does she want to emulate that?
He gets up early and he's wonderful at delegating. And I think he's also just always worked from home. He's never had the commuting time and the getting from meeting to meeting time. He's always worked from a phone. And I do think we've all learned that now, haven't we, with this COVID world of like working on Zoom. You do gain a lot more time back in your day when you don't have to be sitting in a car or sitting on a train, bus, getting to work and going from meeting to meeting. So I think that he's just been doing that for the last 50 years. And he's always been a massive advocate for working from home, flexible working. He like really believes that people can get a job done from anywhere. And it's always worked for him.
Okay, so life after COVID, what do you want to see? Do you want to see more of this practice get rolled out? What kind of positives have you taken? Because, you know, everybody knows about the negatives, but we want to hear positive advice about how we can get back cracking at life and make the very best of it.
Okay, so I absolutely don't want to be going jumping to meetings again. I think we can do so much stuff online, gives you so much more time in a day. Obviously, we're going to want to go and see people and do some things that are face to face, but I don't think we need to go back to the hustle and bustle that we used to have to do before. I think the other really positive thing with this is that you can employ so many more different people. So there might be pre-pandemic, there might have been people that wouldn't apply to work in a central office in a company because they were at a life stage where they didn't want to do the commute, or they were caring for somebody else, or they've got a disability. Whereas now so many more people can actually get jobs, get into the workforce. And I think we've just got to make a really concerted effort to get more women back into work. And women have been really particularly affected by coronavirus, either having to go part-time or quit their jobs because they can't juggle everything, or they've lost their jobs, retail's gone. You know, we've got, you know, so many people, women especially, have lost their jobs. So we've all got to be really thinking creatively about how to get more people back into the workforce. And I'm excited about it because I think it's possible.
There have been some hard times for the family. Richard lost his mother, Eve, at the start of 2021. Here are his thoughts on that and Sam's on losing his grandmother to COVID.
Look, we were a very fortunate family. She lived to 96. You know, her mum lived to over 100. Her grandmother lived to over 100. So, you know, so we were expecting that she had a few more years in her, and I suspect she would have done.
And that bodes well for you as well, doesn't it? Longevity in the family.
Well, I'll have to keep fit as well, and that all helps. And I enjoy life, so that's another reason for keeping fit and healthy. But, you know, we're a family that doesn't mourn somebody that we lose and just celebrate their lives. I'm somebody that would not go to a crematorium or a funeral. I just see no point in it. I will, you know, we'll arrange a wonderful memorial, you know, get together with family and friends, and we'll share stories, and that's the way we approach it.
You know, I think like anyone who has a family member that they love pass, it's tough. It's a really strange time in the world, and for her to be lost to this, you know, there's so many families out there who've experienced something similar, and I suppose it, you know, she was 96. She lived a long, full, adventurous, wonderful life and stayed as curious at 96 as she was when she was probably a teenager. And so, you know, and I got to spend a long time with her, of my long part of my life, you know, so far. And I'm just really grateful to have had those times and reflect back on the woman she was. And you know, in someone's passing, you really sort of reflect back on them and the things they taught you. And I just got so much to be grateful for. And of course, I'm sad, but yeah, just what a woman, and happy to have had her for so long.
I think that's the key, isn't it? You know, we have all got to go one day, and if you can let someone go with no regrets, then that's incredible. What did she teach you then? What are your sort of abiding memories of her, and perhaps actually what she passed down to your dad and then on to you? Because it seems you definitely all do have that adventurous spirit.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, there's lots of different things. I think, you know, having an insatiable curiosity. I think curiosity keeps you young. And she was just never, I mean, people would try and treat her like an old woman sometimes because she looked old, and she would just have absolutely none of it. And, you know, there's a few fun stories. So, like, I remember we did the Jamaica inaugural, which is the first flight where Virgin started flying there. And I piggybacked along for the experience, and lots of press come, and there's like a couple of days where you like really experience the local culture and give them a flavor of what Jamaica was like. And so we're at this party, and my dad was like, can you keep an eye on Granny? And this is when she was sort of like late 80s, and I'm sitting there, and I'm in the middle of a dinner conversation, and I turn around, and my granny's gone, and I'm like, oh God, my granny's gone. I'm responsible for her. Where is she? And I start panicking, and 10 minutes later, eventually I look up onto the stage with all these Caribbean dancers, and there's my granny front and center having a massive boogie. And I'm just like, oh my God, that's just so my granny, which is really charming. And then my wife, another time, you know, when she was in her early 90s, we were on a plane, and she chatted to my wife, and then she went off. My wife's like, oh, where are you going, Eve? And she says, are you going to have a nap? And my granny was like, no, darling, I'm off to learn French. You know, and just that sort of sense of nonstop learning, you know, age is just a number. So that sort of perspective is definitely something that really reminds me of her. And she said wonderful quotes like, if you don't do it, you haven't done it. You know, she was a big believer in making mistakes and just saying yes to things and seeing what happens.
On top of losing his mother to COVID, the pandemic also presented many challenges for Richard. He explains more.
I mean, COVID was an extraordinary challenge for everybody. I mean, apart from the personal loss, obviously, you know, we launched a cruise company the week that COVID broke out 18 months ago, which was not the best timing to launch Virgin Voyages. And then our airlines have had all their planes grounded pretty well all the time since then, because, you know, it's important that people are fit to avoid COVID. Anyway, they've been pretty well closed all this time. Hotels have been closed. Anyway, it's been challenging, but we're fortunately coming through the end of it. And at least the government have managed to get an incredible number of people vaccinated in the UK, which bodes very well for the future.
Mm. What did you learn from the pandemic?
We have extraordinary people, both in the family and in all our companies. They've just worked so incredibly hard to keep every single company going and as many jobs as possible saved. And you know, I think the companies will come out, will come through it, and they'll be the stronger for it. Everything in the end is about people. And if you surround yourself with a wonderful team of people, then you can enjoy the good times, but also get through the bad times together.
Many of the listeners of this podcast are crazy about Formula One, and obviously you enjoyed little foray into F1. Tell us about your memories of that experience.
We were very superficially involved with Formula One, and now we're proudly involved with the Formula E. We got very lucky when Rubens Barrichello rang me one day and said that his team was not going to be able to participate in Formula One because Honda, I think, had decided not to carry on supporting them, and they needed a certain amount of money to be able to go to Australia. And anyway, we came up with the money, Virgin on the side of the cup, Rubens and Jason won the first race, and I'm afraid to say that I got so drunk that night that I think I embarrassed myself. But anyway, it was a fun day. And then move the clock forward a few years, we were supporting another car, and on this occasion we lost, and I'd had a friendly bet with Tony Fernandez, and he was going to be a stewardess on our plane, and if he lost, then I was going to be a stewardess on his if I lost, and anyway we lost, and I was the most dashing Air Asia stewardess that they've ever had on board.
So you did actually come good on the bet, and you got dressed up and served drinks.
I did come good on the bet. I did serve drinks. I did dump 12 glasses of orange juice on Tony Fernandez's lap, but as I wasn't a very good stewardess.
Okay, so he may well be a terrible air hostess, but Richard is clearly a trailblazer in most things he does, always looking to implement social reform and liberal ideas well before others have even considered them. It seems he's always applied this approach as a parent and a businessman. We've touched on before how kind of progressive you and Joan are, and were certainly as the kids were growing up. And one of the things that Holly shared with us was the fact that she identified as a boy for some time. And actually your response and reaction to that was so confidence boosting for her, that it really mattered at a time when, you know, she's just learning about herself and the world. And your response to her made all the difference. Again, it seems as if you've always cared about diversity, opening your arms up and welcoming in anyone, however they identify. And well before it was kind of at the forefront of everybody's discussion, it's, you know, it's imperative now for companies to be doing that. But you were leading the way. Why did it matter so much to you?
I think from a very young age, I set up an advisory centre for young people who had problems. And a lot of the people that came to us were young gay people. You know, I was about 16 at the time. It was called the Student Advisory Centre. And, you know, it became very apparent to me that very quickly that, you know, people who were gay were born gay. You know, they had no choice in the matter. And what they needed was support and love. And they needed to meet other gay people. And they didn't. The last thing they needed was to be ostracized. And in those days, a lot of these kids had sort of fled from Cardiff or north of England to London because they were, you know, they were in danger of being ostracized by their families and their friends. you know, so I was lucky to, you know, experience life to its full. I mean, you know, we dealt with suicidal cases, we dealt with venereal disease cases, we dealt with psychiatric cases, suicidal cases, everything. So it was an incredible education. So when it came to bringing up our own kids, you know, if one of our kids looked like they've met being a girl, but maybe wanting to be a boy. Anyway, it was just something that we both dealt with completely naturally. And obviously, you know, we're lucky enough because of, I think, our experiences in life to, yeah, just give that person unremitting love and support.
Now I look back and find it really interesting. So I, at the age of 4, decided I was a boy. It wasn't that I wanted to be a boy. It was that I was a boy. It was just after my brother was born. And I don't know, looking back on it now, whether it's some sort of psychological thing that a boy was born and was getting lots of attention and I wanted to be like him, or, I mean, there's no reasoning, like obvious reasoning behind it. But I absolutely believed I was a boy. I stood up to pee. I dressed like a boy. I even sort of gave myself different male names. And this wasn't just a quick thing that stopped after a few months, few years. It lasted till I was nearly 11. And so it was quite unusual for, you know, especially at that time, nearly 40 years ago, you know, I was so lucky to have parents that were really accepting of it. And they didn't question anything. They just sort of let me be who I wanted to be. Unconditional love, which I think as parents now we realize just how important that is. And then when I was 11, I asked my mum for a dress for Christmas. And she thought, oh, I'm not going to give her Holly a dress. It won't be from me, in case that feels like too pressurized. I'll get one of my family friends to give Holly a dress for Christmas. And they did. And that was the turning point. And from then on, I was back to being female Holly, or identifying as female Holly again. I think they were just taking each day as it comes. And as long as I was happy, they were happy.
But that's so cool, so, because 30 years ago, that wasn't the way many parents would have approached it.
I know, exactly. But they've been very relaxed. You know, they've always been parents that have been very much about, you know, as long as we're happy, they're happy, and unconditional love. And we still have it now. I mean, I'm so lucky to have both my parents still around now, but it is all about unconditional love for us, unconditional love for our their grandchildren now, who actually have taken first fiddle. You know, we are definitely second fiddle now. Everything, all energy goes on there. I'm sure you find the same with your kids. It's just, you know, loving your child for who they are. And they've just done that wholeheartedly from the beginning. No pressure in any direction. It's been a lovely way to be brought up.
That is really lovely. And what about standing up to wee? You say that you learned to do it. I don't physically know how a girl does that.
I was skillful at it. I was brilliant at it. I mean, you know, it was one of my party tricks, really. You know, it was just one of those things that I did, and my cousins all found it. You know, they all found it funny, but to me, that was the way that I did it. No, I, you know, there's a way you can. It's all about the angles, Natalie.
Richard has always been an advocate for inclusion and diversity, something that other global companies have played catch up on.
Are you surprised that companies, I mean, because it feels like we still have a long way to go, but are you surprised that it's taken this long for them to come to the party and realise that diversity and inclusion are really the foundations for great business?
Companies are basically are individuals who run them, who've come from all sorts of different backgrounds. And, you know, I think a lot of these people who run their companies or run departments in companies, you know, they were forced to wear a tie, they were forced to wear a suit, then they got people working for them and they're damned if they're gonna, you know, why should these people not suffer too? I had to suffer for years wearing a tie and a suit. You know, there's a little bit of that, I think. But I can't blame people who haven't really been out in the world and, you know, seen what's going on in the world and fully understanding things. I think, you know, that in time, people are beginning to broaden their minds and, you know, treat people better. But it's not black and white that, you know, these people are bad because they don't do this. I think they just need to be better educated, a lot of these people, into, you know, into some of these issues.
So how does Holly, as Chief Purpose and Vision Officer, see Virgin's future?
I would love Virgin to be as fully diverse and inclusive as it possibly could be. We absolutely are trying very hard already. But how cool if we could look back to say that 100% of our people felt they could be 100% themselves at work, that they could be themselves, they could express themselves, that we had all the right ratios of people across from all different walks of life, from all different races, all different ethnicities, all different, different LGBTQ orientations, whether people had disabilities. Like, I would just love for Virgin to be that place that anybody and everybody felt comfortable to work, and that we had absolutely nailed that. And so I'm working hard at the moment. It's a difficult process, and it's one that we definitely have not got there yet. But I love the fact that there's a journey and there's a target at the end of it.
It feels as if it's always been a collaborative process, something that you sit round and I can imagine you as a family just having these big meals and discussing what matters to you and how to take the business forward. So really, I mean, I guess you've always worked together for this goal, you know, an ambitious one, but one that doesn't feel as if it's just been a hashtag that's transient that could pass. This is actually in your DNA. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And what's great is that we do. So the other day I was chatting to Dad about how, I absolutely want to fully embed diversity and inclusion in everything that we do. And he said, oh, interestingly, I've got a call with the B team tomorrow morning. You should, on exactly that topic, you should join us. And so it's that sort of thing where, because, you know, we talk to each other a lot about the different areas that we're working on, and we both have these different phone calls and we can be like, oh, Dad, you should join this one, or Holly, you should join that one. And it's really great. I love being on a call with him. That was a particularly special one with lots of the B team members. So I felt very honored to be a part of that. It's great. And we can learn so much from each other.
So we've heard what his children think of him, but how does the big man describe himself?
Well, Richard is somebody who loves to learn. He sees every minute of every day out of a learning process. He's very inquisitive. He does not know how to say no, so he gets into trouble a lot. He's known as Dr. Yes by his colleagues. He loves adventure, but accepts that he's going to fall flat on his face on occasions, or maybe more occasions than he would like. I think he's a family man who absolutely adores his family. He's lucky enough to have a wonderful collection of friends around him. Lucky enough to have chosen a wonderful mother for his children. Yeah, and I suspect his principal fault is saying yes too often.
Sam also said that he thought you were shy. And would you agree with that? And how do you marry that with your very sort of public persona? And the sort of king of PR, if you like.
I was shy. My mum attempted to take it away from me. You know, she said shyness was selfish, and you know, she'd make us stand on the stage and perform in front of the family. You know, the first interview I ever did for Radio 4, Tony Howard was the interviewer, and he sent me two tapes. One tape was all my ers and ums, which was longer than the actual tape that they broadcast, because he was very kindly spliced out all the ers and ums of the interview. I had to train myself to overcome it. In those days, there wasn't the internet, you know, so the only way you could actually get your company to be well known was to make a fool of yourself, put a pilot's uniform on if you're launching an airline, and I don't know, just throw yourself wholeheartedly into whatever I did. And, you know, over time, I managed to overcome the shyness, and I think some people listening to this broadcast will laugh with the idea that I could have ever been shy somehow.
Shyness, a lack of confidence, and a journey of personal growth are all things Sam can relate to as well.
I went to do a speech I've done 20 times before to a group of kids, and 5 minutes into the talk, I just froze, and I basically internally said, I've got nothing more to say, and I walked off the stage, and I was like, what's going on? Like, this is just, you know, and that was like really not my confidence, and sent me on a bit of a self path, the journey, sort of internal journey of like, okay, what happened there? What's going on? And, you know, amongst other things, part of it was that I was doing these things, but I wasn't really pursuing, you know, or putting time into something that I knew was my deepest, biggest passion. And I used to watch singers and stuff and it was amazing, but I would also like die inside. I was like, oh God, that's my dream. And I'm not at least trying to do it. And that was a kind of turning point and lots of other personal growth I went on. But the music side, I was like, right, I remember watching something going, I'm never going to be frustrated ever again with music. I'm going to use this as a fuel in which to hone the craft, to search for my sound, for my vibe, to share what it is that I love with people. And that's been a wonderful journey in the last few years, honing the craft and writing songs and collaborating with people. And I've now got a wonderful bank of music. And the first song is the one I wrote after the last time I saw my granny. And I'll probably be releasing a new song every sort of 5 weeks for the next foreseeable future.
Communication is clearly crucial in everything the family does. And I asked Richard about a letter he wrote to his children just before one of his dangerous expeditions.
I did actually read quite a moving letter that you wrote to Holly and Sam that you put in your first autobiography when you're back in Marrakesh in the late 90s. Just tell us why you felt the need to write that. Did you really think you wouldn't see them again?
Obviously, I didn't think that I would never see them again. But if you're heading off around the world in a hot air balloon and it hasn't been attempted before, it is certainly a possibility that something could go wrong. And I think it's really important, you know, whether you're young embarking on an adventure like that or old coming near the end of your life, that you communicate, you know, with your children and your friends, sharing some last words. And I wanted to get across to them that, you know, that they had a remarkable mum who's quite capable of finishing bringing them up. You know, that I hope that they would be adventurous when they grew up as well. And they, you know, as it turned out, I'm lucky enough to have been around to see them grow up and see them be adventurous and see them striving every year and doing extraordinary things. I now have to watch, you know, Sam climbing the Matterhorn and go through the pain of, you know, not being sure whether he'll come back again and so on. There's been an element of role reversal that's taken place.
Do you know what? I think this should encourage every parent out there to put pen to paper and send their kids a letter. I think it's great to share that with your kids. And hopefully you'll see them again the next morning. Richard, it has been an absolute pleasure. I've taken up way too much of your time as it is. And I know that you're in hot demand. So thank you so very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Natalie. Lovely to talk to you too, as always.
Huge thanks then to Richard, Holly and Sam. And you can hear our full unedited conversations because I spoke to them individually for over an hour and I will be releasing those over the next few weeks. Keep your feedback coming in. Please rate, review and subscribe. It's always lovely to have your company and to hear your thoughts. You can still win those Bose noise cancelling headphones too. So make sure you tag a friend to be in with a chance. Thanks again to the Bransons. They remind us all of the vital importance of family in whatever form that takes for each of us. Until next week, friends, thank you for listening. We will speak again soon on In the Pink. This week's episode of In the Pink was brought to you by F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program for Formula One. If you want to witness firsthand this epic 2021 battle between Mercedes and Red Bull, then quite simply, there is no better way to do it than with F1 Experiences. They offer access that you simply can't get anywhere else. And as an In the Pink listener, you can save 5% on your next F1 Experiences package. Just use the code In the Pink, all capital letters, or one word, when checking out online at F1Experiences.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.